Sometimes it can be tempting to avoid talking about or even thinking about very serious health concerns. Brain cancer certainly isn't pleasant to think about, but it's important to know what risk factors you might have, and it's also encouraging to hear about some exciting advances that are being made right here in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. A couple of guests for you today. Dr. John Kuo, one of our guests, Assistant Professor of Neurological Surgery and Human Oncology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He also directs the Comprehensive Brain Tumor Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics and is co-director of the UW Comprehensive Cancer Center Multidisciplinary Brain Tumor Clinic. So that's a lot of titles there, but well deserved. And thank you so much, Dr. Kuo, for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us today, Dr. Jamie Weichert. Dr. Weichert is currently an associate professor of radiology and also holds affiliate positions in medical physics and pharmaceuticals, or at pharmaceutics, I think is the way to say it, isn't it?
Yep, that's right.
At the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Dr. Weichert, thank you for coming by as well. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
Really important topic. John, how common are brain tumors? And when you have a tumor, is it always malignant?
Well, that's a complicated question. Tumors that grow in the brain can be benign or malignant. But a lot of times when people think about brain cancer, they're actually thinking about cancer that's spread from elsewhere in the body, like lung cancer, breast cancer, even melanoma or colorectal cancer to the brain. Primary brain cancer, in other words, cancer that grows from the tissues of the brain, are rather rare and uncommon. But certainly anything growing that is extra, whether it be benign, slow-growing, or rapidly fast-growing cancer inside the head where there's a limited amount of space, is going to cause important problems and symptoms.
Yeah, for sure. And there are many different types of cancer that could be an issue here, and which ones are the most common?
Well, the most frequently found cancers that spread to the brain would be lung cancer and breast cancer, certainly, because those are the most common cancers. But the most frequently diagnosed primary brain cancer that grows from brain cells is something called an astrocytoma, and the worst form of it is the glioblastoma. Okay. Or GBM.
GBM, okay. Are there I'm sure there are factors that are maybe associated with developing brain tumors?
Actually, there isn't very much that's known about what causes brain cancers or even benign brain tumors. But previous exposure to radiation therapy, for example, or a lot of radiation might be one association. Or the predisposition of environmental exposure to carcinogens so that you can get other types of cancers can also lead to more frequent brain cancer.
I'm going to give our listeners a chance to join in. Have you or someone close to you been diagnosed with a brain tumor? What's your experience been? If you have lived through a cancer diagnosis, what do you want others to know about that? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions or your comments there. Dr. Weichert, Jamie Weichert, how have brain tumors traditionally been detected?
So typically, I think John can answer that one probably better than I can. But I think typically people get symptomatic, don't they, John? And you know, John can address that probably better than I can because he's a medical doctor.
Yeah. So
most of the times people come in with headaches or weakness or even a seizure in a younger person. And CAT scans, or especially MRI scans with contrast, will show areas of the brain that leak dye across the blood-brain barrier. And many times this could be a tumor, but it could also be other things mistaken for infection or stroke or inflammation or multiple sclerosis or other diseases. So it requires surgery and biopsy to definitively diagnose it.
Yeah, and we have, you mentioned youth, young people, and so this is not, it's not always somebody as old as me. Young people can have this problem too.
Correct.
Yeah. How young has it occurred?
Well, there are pediatric forms of brain cancer, okay. Medulloblastoma, but glioblastoma is more of a disease of people 30 and up usually, and the higher the age, the higher the incidence sometimes.
Well, Jamie, you and John have developed a new diagnostic tool. I obviously want to talk about that. How did you get the idea for it?
So we've developed a platform, a molecule that selectively targets a very broad variety of cancers. Of course, my collaboration with John focuses on brain tumors and brain metastases. John is a neurosurgeon. It's very important. I developed the drug, and then I hand it over to the clinicians, and they actually see what it can and can't do. And so this agent is now blossomed into a variety of different agents now because of its ability to localize in tumor following an intravenous injection. It homes in on the tumors and lights them up. And today we've done over 60 different kinds of cancer. John's lab focuses on cancer stem cells, and we know that these molecules can actually enter cancer stem cells. And so we're very excited about this. Couldn't have done any of this without the collaboration with John, to be honest. And, you know, as a PhD, my role in drug development is to get it to the clinical level and then let the clinicians actually see what it can and can't do. So we're very excited about it. And, I can't wait to see what the limitations are, as well as to see if we can better what's being done currently.
Well, it sounds amazing. How many? 50?
Over 60 different cancer types. There are three that it didn't focus in on.
Well, I was quite skeptical at first. My laboratory works on therapeutic resistant cells, the cancer stem-like cells that can sort of seed the recurrences and grow the whole tumor again. And we work on in a tissue culture as well as in animals, and now this agent's been tested both tissue culture animals as well as in early phase human clinical trials and appear to home in and be stuck in the cancer cells despite it being lung cancer or breast cancer or brain cancer. So it's terrific in terms of its broad specificity, and sort of has made me overcome my skepticism.
Well, and these stem cell cancers, they're the mean ones. Well, they're all mean, but these are particularly mean, aren't they? Because they're the ones that if you miss...
Exactly. So the idea being that all the treatments we have now, the surgery, the radiation, and chemotherapy, cannot cure certain cancers like brain cancer, or even things that we can control later on, even lung cancer or breast cancer, come out of control and metastasize because there are resistant cells, and the cancer stem-like cells seem to be a big part of that. And they're like the seeds of the tumor that can cause the fire again to grow.
So with this method, you can actually identify those and then get rid of them.
Well, this platform, these agents don't miss those cells.
Yeah, they don't miss them. So
whereas current therapies do miss them.
So then you can then, once you've identified them, then you can home in on them.
Absolutely. And the idea is that this platform allows us to tag diagnostic label, so we can do PET scans, and then fluorescence also, so we can actually visualize during the surgeries where the tumor cells are. And then thirdly, one could even, and now in early clinical trials, tag therapy to it so that the therapy goes to the exact same cells that we image and visualize. And that's the potential of this.
Wow. How did you happen to...
It's a great question. And actually, how we came upon this was there was a paper way back in 1970, and I always have to tell the students, you know, believe it or not, research actually happened before you were born. And so if you look at this paper by Snyder, he noticed that cancer cells had an overabundance of a certain type of lipid or fat molecule. And so, and he attributed that to the fact that these cells lack the enzyme to actually clear these molecules out. So as medicinal chemists, we started making molecules to try to take advantage of that difference between normal cells and cancer cells. And we actually made 30-some analogs, different chemical molecules that were all related in structure. And from those 35 analogs, 36, we now know which parts of the molecule are really important for targeting the tumor. And the other thing that John may have mentioned here was that these target the tumor, but then they stay in the tumor cells. So they have this prolonged retention, which is where the therapy aspect comes in, because now we can put a radioactive molecule, for instance, on this, and it can radiate the cells from the inside. Obviously, we want to be able to radiate cancer cells and cancer stem cells, but we don't want to radiate normal cells, and that's where we are. John mentioned we've done trials. We're actually doing our 9th clinical trial right now, 4 or 5 of them all going on at the same time. We've now spread out to 9 other sites around the country in our lead use here, and that's in detecting brain tumors with John and gliomas. That we're doing a phase 2 study with that now at soon to be 9 or 10 sites around the United States.
Wow.
So it's expanding now, and we're very excited now because, as I said before, I've been working on these for well over 10 years, closer to 15 years, and now we're finally to the point where we can see what they can and can't do. And so
it's wonderful. And when can we expect, when are these going to be available for use? I mean, you're testing with them now, but
yeah, we've been doing clinical trials for, geez, I think 4 or 5 years now, and we're probably still 3-4 years away from having an imaging agent, and that'll be our first one. And the reason I say that is because we did get designation as a to be able to develop these as an orphan drug. So that's a special designation that the FDA gives for drugs that are aimed at cancers, for instance, that don't have any viable ways of treating them. So, and they'll allow you to move a little faster through the development pathway. But as you know, developing a drug takes years and literally hundreds of millions of dollars to get them finally approved. So,
I think what's beautiful about these agents is that the normal cells and normal tissue can metabolize or get rid of them. While we don't have the detailed molecular biology, and that's another sort of few PhD projects in our labs, it has a high and very good safety profile. And we have to thank all our patients of many different cancers, not just brain cancer, who have participated in the trials to show us how safe it is and who will be key to helping us prove it, its use, both for diagnostics and maybe even in the future for therapy for many different cancers through the cancer centers.
Just wonderful, wonderful news. Talking with Dr. John Kuo and Dr. Jamie Weicker today about new developments in the detection of cancers, many cancers, including brain cancer, we've kind of zeroed in a little bit on. Certainly looking forward to your questions, and I see we have lots of callers online right now. You can join in. I think there's one more open line at 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. I'm Larry Miller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer today, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Miller here as we talk about some great research that's been done here at the University of Wisconsin that's leading to some wonderful early detections of brain cancers and other cancers, as well as we visit with our two guests, Dr. John Kuo and Dr. Jamie Weickert of the University of Wisconsin. Wonderful to have them along. Certainly you can join in with your own questions or comments. Doug in Bayfield, Wisconsin, up first here. Hi, Doug. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, my wife passed away from brain cancer. She had a glioblastoma grade 4. She had a seizure September 22nd of 2013, and that was the first indication that we had that there was anything wrong. In fact, she had been training to do a half marathon. She was 59 years old and doing a half marathon that fall. But she underwent radiation. They couldn't remove any of the tumor because of the location when they did the biopsy. But she underwent radiation and chemo October and November. And in the first part of December, she was in her last week of treatment, first round of treatment. And she started developing severe back pain when they started weaning her off the steroids. And they found out it had spread to her lower spinal cord.
Yeah.
And that, by the time they were able to diagnose that it was definitively there, she had deteriorated so bad that she couldn't undergo any more treatment. And she passed away on Christmas Eve of that year. But I my main question is, at that time, the doctors had told me that there wasn't, we have three children, adult children, but there wasn't any indication of a genetic transfer of brain tumors, and just if they can verify that.
Sure.
Sure. I'm sorry about your loss. The story you're telling us is very typical of glioblastoma, unfortunately, striking down people in the prime of life and only coming in with seizures. By then, it's somewhat spread. And brain cancer, unlike a melanoma or unlike other tumors like breast cancer, can't be removed totally because it infiltrates and sometimes is stuck in normal parts of the brain. There's usually no genetic predisposition unless you're from families that have a genetic predisposition to many different cancers, including glioblastoma. It is rather rare.
Okay. So that's sounds like something that Doug can breathe a little bit?
Yes.
Sigh of relief on that one? Okay. Doug, thank you for calling. I want to give Drew in La Crosse a chance to join us. Hi, Drew. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me. So I'm planning on going into primary care, the family practice doc in Wisconsin, and that background makes me wonder about a future role with this tool and screening at all.
Dr. John Kuo, will you comment?
Well, first of all, congratulations, and I hope and applaud your work, because as a primary care physician, you'll be seeing a lot more difficult problems, I think, than brain cancer. Hopefully, you'll remember to send them to the cancer center for us. The tool, as you say, or the platform, is still not a product. And I have to say first, I have no relationship with the spinoff company, Selectar, that Jamie has been able to found and try to take this, along with NIH and federal support, to a product. That would be sort of more pie in the sky in the future, I think, because of how selective this agent might be. We would like to dream that one can use this to look for tumors in people. But I think a more immediate application, and one that is filling a very important clinical challenge, is being able to follow patients after they get current treatments and discriminate whether their cancer is coming back or not, whether their treatments are failing. Because this agent's cancer is selective and cancer specific, whereas current advanced imaging like MRI is really looking for areas that the contrast dye leaks across blood-brain barrier. So it's not looking for cancer.
Yeah.
And many times my colleagues in the brain tumor team and I look at a patient's scan while they're getting therapy or after they've received their radiation chemotherapy, and we wonder, is this change because the dye is leaking across, scar, or is it really cancer coming back? And that really, as you can tell, impacts quite a bit on people's care.
Of course.
So this agent might play a role there, and that's actually one of the goals of the clinical trials as a diagnostic agent, since it's so cancer selective.
Very good.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Drew, for calling. Appreciate it. So your company then, Jamie, is what's your company?
It's called Selectar.
Selectar?
Cell-selective targeting. That's where it came from.
Oh, okay. And it's something that through the company you're working on developing.
Absolutely. And it's in Madison. We've got about 25 employees. One of the reasons I actually came here from Ann Arbor was because of the environment here for supporting entrepreneurialism. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that I think to date we've raised over $75 million to develop these kinds of drugs.
Well, it's wonderful to know that there's financial backing for this kind of work because, well, if you have a loved one with any cancer that. Money is no longer becomes an object. So it's great to see that we're having people put their money forward. Do you have a website, by the way?
Yeah, there is selectar.com.
Selectar, and it's so select.
CELLECTAR.
Selectar.com.
Selective targeting, yep.
So we should put that up on our Facebook page. Yeah, Cheyenne's going to put that up on our Facebook page.
The other side of it, Larry, is that, and this is why I came to Wisconsin, is the exciting research environment at the university. The Carbone Cancer Center in neurosurgery and human oncology, as well as stem cell center, because as you can tell, I work on abnormal stem cells, cancer stem cells. And we've gotten a lot of support from the community, from patients, families, the Head Rush Foundation with Brandy Funk and her family, Lois Loft and the Farming Against Brain Cancer. All of these things make the science possible because companies may be interested in products, and I think they need to make the last step of developing these agents. But with NIH and with the community support, we've been able to do a lot of exciting science to make the product feasible. That's really cool. The two parts that make this environment a terrific one.
I can remember many fine conversations with Paul Carbone. I'm old enough to have done that and had him on this program.
Absolutely.
So it's great to know. And Drew, thank you again. Patty in Eau Claire, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for your good work. I have a happy story to tell. Our family was paralyzed last year when my four-month-old granddaughter was diagnosed with two forms of brain cancer. One was a mass and one was cellular. And she was in the good hands of doctors at the Dorn Becker Children's Hospital in Portland. And through surgery, it was removed. I had no idea that doctors could chase cells and remove them. Now, she has had MRIs every 3 months, and she is cancer-free, and we are celebrating her first birthday.
Congratulations, so. Patty. That's terrific.
Yes. But it hovers around. And, you don't use chemotherapy and radiation on that young of a brain. So we did a little research, just very little when I had the courage to do it. And I found out some stuff about the Brzezinski Cancer Institute. Now, I understand it has been controversial, but supposedly there's been some good work done there on little ones without using chemo and radiation. And you've probably said this. Now, I'm going to go on your website and gather as much information as I can. But does your work, are you anticipating that it could be used on little ones that young?
Hmm.
So the clinical trials have been done in adults so far. And I think you highlight the massive challenges we have in the brain cancer field. There's so many different types. They're rather rare. You also have pediatric cancers, as we talked about. And this is why I think the common effort and the federal government and through the NIH are attacking brain cancer as one of the hallmark ones for the Cancer Genome Project, because we want to understand cancer at the molecular biology level, mutation level, and to be able to then take this knowledge and translate it into diagnosis and therapies.
Well, Patty, we're all three of us here are, I'm sure, we have smiles on our faces when you were talking about how well your granddaughter has come along. Thank you so much for talking about it. You're right about the Borzinski being controversial, and we really haven't looked into that to comment on it. But I appreciate your call and your questions. And just to follow up on that, do you see any abnormal behaviors or anything coming from the actual treatment so far that you with the chemicals that you use?
Yeah, I don't think thus far, especially in imaging, we don't see any subsequent side effects or anything like
that's
that.
That's what I...
Because we're given a... You know, the thing you got to remember, Larry, is that the amount of drug that we actually give with positron emission tomography is so small.
I mean, a
human literally gets 10, 20 micrograms total dose. So it's not like chemo or some of these other agents where you're getting some pretty hefty dose levels. This is a tracer amount, and so we don't expect that, but we still have to do the trials and monitor everything anyway.
So. We have open lines again. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. I apologize for not giving the number earlier or again, but I'll do it right now. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question or comment as we talk with our guests about the developments in detecting cancers, and we've zeroed in a bit on brain cancer. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. John, I got a call from John who couldn't hang on the line but wondered about brain cancer and cell phones. And there's been, you know, I've heard those stories. I'm sure you guys have heard those stories as well. Dr. Kuo, what about
it? I like to tell my medical students and that we're all participating in the biggest uncontrolled clinical trial ever with cell phones. The problem is we're shooting at a moving target, right? Because all the cell phone technology changes. And they've been reducing the radiation on the cell phones. Second thing is the large studies that have found or not found associations have actually been for benign tumors of the hearing nerve. You might expect that that's the part that of the brain that's closest to any sort of radiation. And I think that jury is still out, but most people would say it's probably more dangerous to text and drive or to be reading your email while you're driving than to worry about some sort of tumor that may arise from this technology.
Yeah, so it's that's a good way to put it, though. It's the largest ever uncontrolled you wouldn't call it research, I guess.
It's a trial, I guess.
it's probably a trial. Well, Peggy in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn next. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. Well, I heard you mention multiple cancers in a family. Uh-huh. Now, my oldest sibling had a lung cancer that spread to his brain. And one of my sisters had a glioblastoma, stage 4. And the doctor said, with treatment, you will have 2 years, and with no treatment, 6 months. And she died in 6 months in spite of the fact that she took chemo and radiation and everything. And I have a sister now who had surgery 2 years ago for ovarian cancer. And I heard you mention something about families with multiple cancers, and I was just wondering about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think, first of all, I'm sorry about your loss and all of the things your family is going through. There are things that you can bring up. These are things that you should be bringing up when you talk to your primary care physician or your family doctor, because there are rare genetic syndromes that cause families to have multiple runs of different types of cancers that may include brain cancer. But what you're describing to me could also be environmental or just luck of the draw, unfortunately, because it sounds like you're in different systems of organs. But again, if you have any question or any listener out there with any questions and are concerned, they should bring it up with their family physician when they next visit them.
Uh-huh. And what do you ask? What do you ask your family?
Well, I would relate relate the history and who has gotten what sort of tumors or cancers, and they can start thinking about syndromes or thinking about ways of testing to reassure you or to establish a link.
Mm. Peggy, thank you for calling. What's the survival rate for brain cancer, by the way?
Well, I think that Peggy did bring up the right numbers. Overall, for all comers, we're looking at somewhere around a year and a half to no more than 2 years, even with maximal therapy. And that's just the average. There are subsets of patients with brain cancers with specific mutations that will be a median, will enjoy a median of maybe up to 2 years or 2.5 years. And we have some people who are more long-term survivors. And actually, the NIH is running a big study right now to see why we have the extraordinary responders, because all of these patients get state-of-the-art treatment in terms of maximal surgery and chemotherapy and radiation. But that also speaks to the fact that we need to do better. We need to do more. And that's where this research and many others around the country in their research are taking us.
Yeah.
Better understand mutations with the Cancer Genome Atlas Project, but also alternative approaches like what we're doing, which is a natural mimic of lipid.
Yeah, it's this research is just so wonderful, and it's so much promise. Jamie, comment from you?
Yeah, I would just bring up one of the possible ways that we might be able to help, and of course we haven't even done a clinical trial with this compound yet, but it is teeing up right now, is one version of this molecule actually causes the tumors to glow. And so for somebody like John, who has to be, obviously in the brain you can't take a big margin, right? Because
right.
We need those brain cells. And so one of the things we might be able to do, and like I said, based on our animal study so far, and John just had a major publication come out to this topic, was that we may be able to light these tumors up so John can actually tell where the margins of the tumor are much better than he can do now. And, you know, he might comment on that, because this is a really, really hot topic now in drug development. Is an agent now that can delineate the margin of the tumor very nicely for our surgeons.
Wow.
So, in real time during surgery.
Wow.
So.
Comment, John?
That is exciting, because as we've talked about, the basic science is telling us that we're not missing the cancer stem cells and the infiltrating cells. So this way we can, during the surgery, whether it's in the brain or other types of cancers like lung or breast, be able to take out more tumor cells safely, but also to know that whatever we're leaving there will be targeted by the same platform when we come back with therapy, or will be imaged appropriately.
Yeah.
So that's the beauty of the platform here.
Is the kind of surgery these days, is it you with a steady hand? Do you have, how is that sort of thing done anymore?
Well, my colleagues and I train long hours to do this, but we do use advanced state-of-the-art technology in terms of microscopes, in terms of computer navigation technology to get right at the tumors inside the skull. And I think that, you know, modern neurosurgery is pretty amazing because of the advances from the silicon chip and of the foresight of people developing microscopy.
Yeah, it's just amazing. We had a question from John, who survived glioblastoma and is now a 7-year survivor. When he was diagnosed, they did genetic testing. Could you describe genetic testing? What happens with genetic testing?
First of all, that's great that John should enroll in the extraordinary responder clinical trial at NIH. If he's such a long-term survivor, he's one of the very few in that small tail of people in the statistics. Secondly, when he's talking about genetic testing, I'm guessing now he's talking about the testing that was done on the tumor specimens. And remember, we only take out small bits of tumor at a time. And currently, when we find that there are specific mutations, we can determine how chemosensitive it is, or whether it's something that arose from a lower-grade tumor that transformed. And all of this, while most of it is still research stage, may also allow particular GBM or glioblastoma patients these days to enroll in specific clinical trials against specific mutations or agents. or even vaccine trials. Now there's a lot of immune vaccine trials for glioblastoma. So as you can see, we're trying to throw everything in the kitchen sink at this cancer still incurable.
Well, and John, how would John, by the way, how would he sign up for that, or at least look into signing up for that?
Perhaps he could call either the physicians that treated him or call us at the Carbone Cancer Center, Cancer Connect, so that we can enroll him in that study, which is through the NIH and is observational, obviously, because we want to try to pull nationally as many patients as possible who are the extraordinary responders into a database so we can identify and find out why they responded so well to the therapies and why they have survived so long.
So he get a hold of you guys at the Carbone Cancer Center? And
that's right, through Cancer Connect.
Cancer Connect, okay. Yes. All right. Well, I tell you, this is really wonderful, wonderful work that you guys are doing. And as you said, Jamie, you've got how many people working on this within your company?
25 people at the company. And you know, I think we've got a pretty big team of collaborators over at the university as well that are doing everything from cellular molecular biology to clinical trials. So it's pretty exciting stuff. I'm really happy to have gotten it. Like I said, my role is to hand it off to John and his colleagues, and it's pretty exciting.
And let them have at it. Well, I tell you what, this is really exciting stuff, and it always. When I have a chance to talk to researchers like you guys, it always makes me proud to be a member of the University of Wisconsin. We got some great people here that are doing a lot of really good work. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. And again, your company, we're going to put that up on our Facebook page. In fact, Cheyenne's probably already got it up there, but
it's called Selectar Biosciences.
Selectar Biosciences.
Just selectar.com for the website. So,
well, thank you both again very much for being with us today. Appreciate it. And Dr. John Kuo, one of our guests, he did not get a promotion during the show. He had a promotion before the show. I called him an assistant professor before the show. He's really an associate professor of neurological surgery and human oncology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, directs the Comprehensive Brain Tumor Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics, and co-director of the UW Comprehensive Cancer Center Multidisciplinary Brain Tumor Clinic. Dr. Jamie Weikert, currently an associate professor of radiology, also holds affiliate positions in medical physics and pharmaceuticals at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. A couple of sharp guys who are really sharp guys who are also nice guys. So that's a plus. That's a big plus. I hope we have a chance to talk with them again as things mm-hmm. develop and move along. It'd be great to have you back. I'd really, really look forward to that. Coming up, you know, this is a kind of a health day today, which is great. We're going to take a look at a healthy eyesight and maintaining healthy eyesight with Dr. Dave Gamm, who also does a fair amount of research. He's a clinician and also a researcher, and we're going to look into some of his research and talk with him about maintaining healthy eyesight and the research that he's doing. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.